First of all, thank you very much to the organizers. So I'm going to be talking about gauge invariant self-force calculations with a spinning secondary. So this has been work I have been doing with my PhD supervisor, Barry Wardell, and more recently, Adam Pound from Southampton too. So I just want to give an in a nutshell slide of the calculation that I'm doing, which is, so I'm restricting myself to a Schwarzschild background spacetime. And so I can calculate my first order metric perturbation, so first order and mass ratio, metric perturbation induced by a secondary in the Reggie-Wheeler-Zirilli formalism in the frequency domain. And so I'm just taking my metric, I have a background Schwarzschild metric plus my first order metric perturbation. I'm sticking that into the field equations and you get the linearized field equations. And you can then manipulate that for to solve instead the Reggie-Wheeler-Zirilli equation for master functions. From those master functions, you can then reconstruct your first order metric perturbation. From that metric perturbation, you can then calculate gravitational self-force gauge invariant quantities. And just to note that I can get my Reggie-Wheeler-Zirilli master functions from the black hole perturbation toolkit. So I gave a kind of similar talk last year. So including the spin and the secondary in these calculations. And there's one big difference I want to highlight. So I'm restricting myself to the most simple case of a spinning secondary body in an emery, which is Schwarzschild background spacetime, circular orbit, and we are anti or aligned spin. And for the spinning people out there, I'm using the Tolchiev spin supplementary condition. So typically how these calculations were done is, we're parametrizing our background motion at fixed radius. So before we're considering the spin of the secondary, maybe we're in a circular orbit, it would be a geodesic. And then when we're adding the spin, we're no longer a geodesic because of the Matheson-Papapetu-Dixon term. And so we have an extra spin dependence in the in the parametrization of the background of the orbit. So in this case, in the fixed radius, you would say, okay, for a given radius, you now add the spin onto the secondary body. How does the corresponding frequency change? And you then will then have a four velocity, which is the geodesic four velocity plus a spin piece. And what we want to do is, for the pole-dipole approximation, we're assuming that the spin of the secondary body is much smaller than the length scale associated with the background spacetime. So what we really want to do is extract out the linear in-spin piece. And to do that last year, I showed you can either numerically extract out your linear and spin piece of your calculation by repeating it for a bunch of different spins and fitting. But that's obviously very expensive. So last year I showed a way using where you just have to solve an extra fourth order ODE and it's a partial annihilator method. And this all comes from the fact that if you have spin dependence in your frequency and your frequency is in your Reggie-Wheeler-Zirilli equation and you need to extract out the linear piece. But more recently, what we've done and gone back since last time is used a more powerful fixed frequency calculation instead of fixed radius. So instead we say, okay, our circular orbit has this frequency, we add in our spin, how does the corresponding radius parameterized in the orbit change? And what that does is it means our four velocity, our background four velocity is now the geodesic four velocity up to spin squared and higher terms. And it's now much more trivial to extract out your linear and spin piece. You're also, because you're doing a fixed frequency calculation, you're readily comparable with PN results, post-Newtonian results. One last thing to note is when we're talking about calculating a gauge invariant quantity, we're referring to this helical gauge condition, and that the frequency appears in there. So between the two parameterizations, you have to be careful about what you mean by the gauge invariance. And so we went back and we changed to parameterize in our fixed frequency way. And now we can straight away do some self-force calculations. And so this is a disbit of calculation. So it's the flux balance and the flux balance law derived by Ace et al. In their 2019 paper. so what we're looking at is it's a disbit of calculation. So it's much more straightforward to do. We don't have to worry about the singular field, the singular contribution from modeling as a point particle, and we don't have to worry about metric completion pieces. So what we're looking at is the total energy flux at the horizon and at infinity, And it's balancing with the local force acting on the particle. And this is the relative difference here. And these are select data points are directly comparable with the Achai et al. Paper, table two. Now that's all well and good for the dissipative calculation, but if we want to do a full conservative gravitational self-force calculation, we need to deal with the singular field. So as I said, that arises from modeling our secondary as a spinning point particle. And so to deal with this, the best way to analyze it is with our Detweiler-Whiting singular field. So this is in the Lorentz gauge, and this result here is not yet specialized, a spin supplementary condition or orbital configuration in general. And it's not specialized to a space-time yet. I did show this last year on a slide. And so this first piece comes from the monopole part of the stress energy. And the second piece comes from the spin dipole piece of the stress energy. Now, even though we're in the Lorentz gauge, if we can so what we want to derive out of this to deal with our singular field in a practical calculation is regularization parameters. And if we derive those in the Lorentz gauge, as long as it's for an engaged invariant quantity, we can use the results in our Reggie Wheeler Zirilli gauge calculations. So what we want, as I said, is these regularization parameters, and they follow from a suitable coordinate expansion of the singular field on the previous page. And then you do a scalar or a tensor harmonic decomposition of the singular field. So up to last year, I had just shown that previous slide, and I was just finished out some scalar regularization parameters, including the spin of the secondary. Now, the problem is our numerical results and stuff are in tensor harmonics. And so the only reason you do scalar harmonics is because they're easier to derive at. And then you could project your tensor harmonic results onto scalar harmonics and use your scalar harmonic regularization parameters. But there are a couple of things in the Reggie Wheeler Zirilli gauge that muddy the waters there. And overall, having tensor harmonic regularization parameters is much better. It's just a bit harder. So we went back and we've done our tensor harmonic regularization parameters. So what you do is once you include your regularization parameters in your mode sum, then it converges. So for example, this is the leading tensor harmonic regularization parameter for the phi-phi components of the first order metric perturbation. And the main thing that's important in the difference between scalar and tensor harmonics is just the fact that it's piecewise in L in this tensor harmonic result. So now we've derived out our regularization parameters. We now want to do our conservative calculation. So Detweiler's redshift invariant is such a quantity, a conservative gauge invariant gravitational self-force quantity. And this was derived for a circular orbit with an anti or aligned spin. So it was generalized to that in the Bini et al. 2018 paper. And what does it correspond to? Well, in the perturbed space-time, it corresponds to 1 over the particle's four velocity, the time component of that. And in terms, so as a function of y, that's roughly speaking our fixed frequency, it looks like this in terms of the metric perturbation. And I guess the main extra piece coming from the spinning secondary is, so HKK has spin dependence in it itself. That's sigma, I should have said, is my dimensionless spin parameter. And then you have this additional extra piece, which is a derivative of the metric perturbation. Now, this quantity Z1, as it stands written like this in terms of the metric, metric perturbation is gauge invariant in the other fixed radius parametrization as well, but it's no longer meaningful as a 1 over the time component of the four velocity. One thing to note is this extra term, in this case with the derivative of HKK, cancels partially with some of the linearization piece. So I'm evaluating HKK on the world line. So that's my R plus my little spin piece in the R. And when I extract out the linear and spin piece of that, this derivative HKK actually cancels with this term up here in this sum together. And this slide is just to show the regularization working. So what are we looking at? We're looking at the spin piece of our invariant redshift. And it's L mode by L mode, and we're taking the absolute value. And so what this is just showing is once you include at least the first two regularization parameters, as you go higher up in L, the contributions of each L mode are getting smaller and smaller. And this is what's allowing our mode sum to converge. And then you can add in more regularization parameters and it will converge faster. And something I should note is we derived that analytically, the first two regularization parameters, and then you can, I mean, we could have kept going and derived the rest, just would have been more involved, but they're also very easy to fit while you're doing the calculations. And so the D, F, and G are fitted. And you can just check that that's working using this plot by putting it over the data points. but what we really want to do is compare our spin piece of this redshift Z1 with the post-Newtonian results in the Beeny et al. Paper. And so what we're looking at is the relative difference between our calculation of the redshift with the post-Newtonian expression in Beeny et al. And what I'm doing is I'm adding an extra term from the post-Newtonian expression each time. And so what we can see is over here in towards the weak field, the more terms you add in of the post-Newtonian expression, the better our agreement gets. And then it gets worse slightly over in the, as we go towards the strong field, the difference is larger as you'd expect. One thing I haven't wrapped my head around yet is why this six, so the y to the 6.5, when you include up to that term, it goes slightly rogue for a second. And then when you add the next term, it sort of goes back to what you expect it to look like. So that's not something I've figured out yet, but overall this graph is showing that we agree very well in where we would expect with the right number of the more terms you add, the n terms.
Yes, about two
left. Okay, that's perfect. I was actually just going to conclude there, so I must have gone a bit fast, but if I miss anything, it can come up in the questions, we can go back. So to conclude, this is the first strong field calculation of a conservative gravitational self-force quantity, including the spin of the secondary. And so what was new from last year, I really need to stress these fixed frequency calculations are much more powerful than doing the fixed radius calculations. And we also have out now complete tensor harmonic regularization parameters for our first order metric perturbation, including the spin terms. So what's next? Well, excuse me. We can calculate other gauge invariants now, including the spin of the secondary. So I know there's some interest in the spin precession invariant, and we could calculate that from our metric perturbation. And other invariants, and also just now extending this to more generic orbital configurations. And that is everything. Excuse me. Are there any questions?
Right. We have one question from Sar. Yes, Sar, you can unmute.
Yeah, thank you. Hi, Josh. That was very nice. Very nice results. I was just the comparison you showed with post-Newtonian. I noticed that you only go out to 0.01, which is R equals 10, which is, I guess, extreme.
Zero.
Yeah, this is frequency, but roughly corresponds to R equals 10, I guess. Is that right?
100.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Point zero, I obviously can't divide. I'm having some disaster at home, so I got distracted. The weird behavior, maybe if you fill this plot more densely, maybe it's one of those typical sign changes that we see. You know, it's where the coefficient of the PN term at that order might be large enough that when you get close enough, it just crosses a zero or something. So I'm sure somebody else told you this, but maybe if you fill this more densely, you will find, you know, between 0.02 and 0.033, you might see something like more terms that dip lower.
Okay. Thanks, Sarp.